This episode is brought to you by Rosetta Stone, the all-in-one language app. With Rosetta Stone, you'll have everything you need to learn a language and use it in the real world. They offer immersive lessons, writing prompts, and engaging activities to prepare you for real-life conversations. You can pick and choose the lessons that work best for you and create a personalized experience that's both fun and engaging. Get ready for life's adventures with 50% off for I Know Dino listeners at rosettastone.com/dino. Hello and welcome to I Know Dino. I'm Garrett.
And I'm Sabrina.
This week in our 272nd episode, we have a bunch of news, including a possible reason why some dinosaur groups didn't get as massive as others, as well as some new dinosaur attractions and other news. We also have Dinosaur of the Day, Tylocephalae, and of course, our fun fact. But before we get into all of that, we always like to thank some of our patrons because they are the driving force behind I Know Dino, and we could not make this podcast without them. This week specifically, we'd like to thank Lucas and Eli, Wyatt, the Georges family, John Heck, Ranger Chris from Dino for Hire, Ray, Oliver E., Andrew and Helena Webb, Callum, Ricky, William, Red Sox Rex, Wouter, Moss Utah Raptor, Verossaraptor, Goji, and Neil Ovenator.
Yeah, thank you so much. We appreciate all of your support. And if you want to get your own shout out or some other what we think are cool rewards, then check out our page at patreon.com/inodino.
Jumping right into the news, as I hinted at the beginning of the episode, the question of why some dinosaurs got big and others didn't, and even why some dinosaurs seem to shrink along their evolutionary lineages, is an ongoing question of why this happens, as well as the question of why this metabolic rate of dinosaurs was different than other similar archosaurs. So we know crocodilians were and still are cold-blooded or ectothermic, and birds, unlike them, even though they're in the same group and came from the same common ancestor, switched over from being cold-blooded to being warm-blooded at some point. And so for a long time, there's been a question of, well, when did that happen? Because we think that the common ancestor of all archosaurs, meaning basically all crocodilians and birds, was cold-blooded, but birds obviously are warm-blooded. So somewhere in that period of dinosaurs, at least a group, at least theropods, must have switched from being cold-blooded to warm-blooded and started behaving significantly differently than crocodilians and other reptiles and stuff that were around at the time. So we've talked a little bit about it before with the metabolic rate. One of our favorite books is The Dinosaur Heresies. It was very important. It was Bob Bakker's big treatise on how dinosaurs were not lumbering giants. They were, in fact, fast-moving predators in some cases, or otherwise fast-moving animals that were eating plants in other cases. And they weren't just giant crocodilian-like animals. We've also talked about how with Jurassic Park, the depiction of things like Gallimimus or those other ornithomimosaurs running around quickly is a pretty accurate depiction. And obviously that is not a cold-blooded kind of movement. That's a really high metabolism driving those bird-like dinosaurs running around.
Yep, you don't see lizards running around like that.
No, definitely not, especially not for long periods of time. And it kind of gives you a clue, too, that they focused on those theropods running, that might be the right place to start, since we do know that birds are warm-blooded, whereas we can't really test any modern ancestors of, say, sauropods, because they all went extinct. So we can't really know as much about them. So the paper this week that I'm talking about is by Enrico Resende and others and published in Science. And in it, they're specifically looking at how theropods became endotherms. And I've used that word a few times already, but I feel like I should define it. Endotherm is basically the scientific version of warm-blooded. You can think literally the endo means inside, the endo part of endotherm. And we get our body temperature from our own internal metabolism, thus endothermic. So we're getting our temperature from the inside. Whereas ectotherms are cold-blooded. Cold-blooded is kind of a silly thing to say because when things have cold blood, they don't move around much. So really what they do is they get their energy from the outside, and the ecto is for outside. So you think about a crocodile laying and basking, it's getting its energy and its warmth from the sun. It's not really cold-blooded, it's just getting its energy from the outside. It does mean that on average, they can be a little bit cooler than warm-blooded animals, but really it has more to do with how they get their energy. Interestingly, the only modern animals that are endotherms are mammals and theropods, also known as birds. Everything else is an ectotherm because it takes a lot of energy to maintain a consistent body temperature and to create your own, you're like your own space heater. Whereas if you imagine you can just get your energy from outside, you can really cut down on the amount of calories you have to take in, and therefore the amount of hunting you have to do and the amount of energy you have to store up in the winter. If there's going to be a long gap, crocodiles can basically just not eat for the winter because they're ectothermic. So their metabolism just slows way down and they're totally fine. But then if you're a bear and you're warm blooded, you have to feast like crazy because even with hibernation, they can't slow their metabolism rate down enough to just kind of sit there idling.
Right. If you think about, we use up energy even when we're sleeping.
Yeah, exactly. Because we have to stay at that consistent body temperature all the time. And it just gobbles up tons of energy. But there are some big benefits to endothermy. So one of the biggest ones is increased mobility, including potentially flying. Because it takes so much energy to do that, you have to really be able to keep your metabolism going at a high rate all the time. And ectotherms just don't have that consistency, so they can't necessarily take care of that. It also means that you might be able to avoid predators better with that increased mobility, being able to pump all that warm blood to the muscles at a moment's notice whenever you need to. Another benefit is foraging efficiency, presumably because it can be continuous. If you think about an alligator that has to lay in the sun for a couple hours to warm up, they're not accomplishing anything in that time. Whereas something warm-blooded, like a mouse, can just be running around eating nonstop all the time. Endotherms can also grow faster as well as more consistently because that high metabolism can help you supply nutrients to your body and keep things growing where you don't have these long periods where if the temperature goes down, you have to just sit around and wait to warm up until you can eat again. And one of the biggest advantages is if you're endothermic, you can potentially spread all over the world. You can be a completely multinational, multi-continent species, or at least group of animals. The only things that are really present in Antarctica are birds, which are endothermic, and things like sea lions, which are mammals and also endothermic. It's really hard to survive in that kind of area as an ectotherm. I mean, I can't even imagine how it would be possible.
It's hard enough as an endotherm.
Yeah. And the other interesting thing about being on Antarctica and other cold places is it requires a pretty specific egg type. Either you have to keep everything inside, like a placental, like we do, and you can keep stuff warm, or you have to directly incubate your egg somehow, like how emperor penguins keep them on their feet or keep it in a nest sitting on it, because you can't just bury it. I mean, you probably can't even dig into the ground because it's going to be too hard. But even if you could, it's not good for eggs to be frozen. So there's a couple of advantages you can already start to see that theropods developed that other dinosaurs might not have necessarily had. The authors summarized their research in a really interesting way, saying that early theropods must have had lower metabolic rates because we think that common ancestor of dinosaurs was an ectotherm and therefore had a lower, slower metabolism. But more recent non-avian dinosaurs were likely, quote unquote, decent thermoregulators with elevated metabolism. And I think it's funny to say like decent thermoregulators. It sort of implies our human bias that more thermoregulation and a higher metabolism is really what you want. So I think when they say decent thermoregulators, they're talking about this other group called mesotherms, which is basically you can keep your thermoregulation, you can keep your temperature pretty constant, but you're not necessarily getting all of the energy from your metabolism. So there are some large animals, potentially something like a sauropod could have been like this too, where just their movement and their digestion and things created so much heat that they didn't necessarily have to have as much metabolism driving their endothermy. And I think sharks are similar too, where they're not really endotherms, but their body temperature is pretty high and pretty consistent just based on being big, having a fair amount of insulation and moving around creates a fair amount of energy. But after theropods got to that sort of steady temperature, mesotherm type place, it seems that they eventually got to that endotherm. You know, you can think of like a hummingbird, really high metabolism, really fast moving, really high energy. And really their biggest finding from the study was that smaller sized animals can get away with an endothermic switch a lot easier than a larger animal. In other words, it would take a lot more energy for a large animal to become purely endothermic than it does for a small animal. And as a side effect of that, a lot of the endothermic lineages seem to kind of shrink over time. So they talk about in the early to mid Jurassic, about 180 to 170 million years ago, there were dinosaurs that were starting to get smaller, presumably because they were switching over from being ectothermic to endothermic. Specifically, they call out Silurosauria, which is basically the group that includes stuff like ornithomimosaurs and a lot of those other bird-ish dinosaurs. Even if they didn't have wings, they're theropods and they have that sort of general bird-ishness to them. A lot of them also had feathers. And it would make sense that feathers might have been involved in the switch too, because obviously if you have to create all your own energy, it's nice if you can keep it rather than it all just immediately escaping into the surroundings. And if you cover yourself in feathers, then you don't have to create as much energy because you can just hold on to it for a little while. So the gist of the paper is basically, we think that some of these theropods might have been shrinking in order to get to their endothermic potential, but at the same time, we can specifically look at this time period in the early to mid Jurassic at that 180 to 170 million years ago, and that might be when the only other group other than mammals, being theropod dinosaurs, got their endothermic abilities. So I don't know if we'll ever figure out a way to test with...
This is really hard to find out.
Yeah, it's really hard to verify. They talk about it a lot in the papers, like this is kind of a hypothesis. And then it's even harder to figure out how you would know about something like a sauropod that doesn't have any living ancestors or even close living relatives.
Right. So it sounds kind of like a thought experiment.
Kind of, but they did back it up with a lot of math and a lot of comparisons mm-hmm. between what they know about their sizes and how high their metabolism seemed like it would have been. So we'll have to see if there's more information on this. It would definitely be interesting to know that like some of these earlier dinosaurs might have actually been the lumbering giants, like the early 1900s, late 1800s depictions.
Right.
And then there were other ones that are more accurate because we always talk about dinosaurs as like one group, like all dinosaurs were warm-blooded, but it seems like that's probably not the case. There were probably some that were cold-blooded and maybe lumbering giants.
Right. They lived so long. There were so many different types.
Exactly. It's kind of like saying all mammals are something. There's always an exception out there.
Platypus.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of platypus-like dinosaurs for sure, like Deinochirus.
In other news, from now until June 1st, the Taylor's Museum in the Netherlands, which is a museum of art and science, has a paleo art exhibit called Dino Makers, and that includes work by paleo artists Kennis and Kennis and Mark Witten. Some pieces include a T-Rex caring for its young, and there are also short videos of people talking about their favorite dinosaurs.
Nice. I think we have heard of that museum before.
I think so too. It's always interesting when it's art and science.
Yeah.
Although like that's exactly what paleo art is. That's why it's so great.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like it could just be a paleo art museum based on that description.
No, I think they have other things too.
I guess that's okay.
In the UK, an iguanodon tail has been found in cliffs near Brighstone on the Isle of Wight. So there was recent cliff movement. There still is. So people need to be careful. There were a lot of warnings if you go to visit. Mm-hmm. And the movement made it easy to spot this iguanodon tail. There's a lot of complete iguanodon skeletons found in the area, but for this particular tail, it's not clear how much of a skeleton is behind it. Again, the cliff is unsafe, especially with all the rain, so might be a while.
It's a good starting point, though. Everybody always says you want that tip of the tail poking out, and then you just go in, and hopefully the rest of it's right in front of you.
Right.
Yeah, I think that that's a really common thing there because that's how people find fossils and you're technically allowed to collect them if they fall out of the cliff, but you're not allowed to dig them out of the cliff. So it's a good place to keep an eye on if you're into fossils.
But beware of the cliff.
Seriously, you don't want to get crushed.
Also in the UK, a dad in Guernsey, Andre Bisson, accidentally ordered a larger than he expected dinosaur for his 4-year-old son, Theo. And we had a few comments like, sure, this was an accident.
That's what the dad said because he wanted it.
Maybe. So Theo's obsessed with dinosaurs and really likes Carnotaurus after he watched the movie Dinosaur. So he's been telling his dad that he wants a big Carnotaurus.
That's an interesting takeaway from the movie Dinosaur because that's the villain.
Yeah.
You watch it. It's like having an obsession with Darth Vader at a young age from watching Star Wars.
They were the coolest looking ones, I think, in the movie.
Yeah.
So it took Andre a while to find a Carnotaurus, and then he heard that Jersey's Tampa Park was selling its dinosaurs, so he bought their Carnotaurus, which he thought was about 3 meters long based on the website information and picture. It's unclear how exactly he got this idea.
So that's about 10 feet. You could fit that. I don't know where you'd fit that anyway.
Well, he thought it would fit nicely next to their hot tub in their backyard.
Okay, outside. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. Cost him about £1,000. This Carnotaurus's name is Chaz, but it turns out Chaz is closer to 6 meters.
So more like 20 feet.
Yep. He also got wet in the rain, which made him heavier, like close to 2 tons.
Oh, wow.
So it took a crane to move Chaz. But they have him, and Theo looks really happy in the pictures.
Nice. I mean, you probably, if you have room for a 10-foot sculpture outside, you probably have room for a 20-foot sculpture, right?
I don't know. Both are hard for me to fathom.
I think we need some dinosaur sculptures.
Maybe not that large.
Well, I'll just do what he did and say, like, well, I thought it was only 8 feet long.
Get the babies. Baby Myasaur, baby.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And last in the news, thanks to Daniel who shared this one with us. So musician Tom Rosenthal shared a short video of his nearly 4-year-old daughter's song called Dinosaurs in Love. And it's very cute. The lyrics, if you're curious, are dinosaurs eating people, dinosaurs in love, dinosaurs having a party. They eat fruit and cucumber. They fell in love. They say thank you. A big bang came and they died. Dinosaurs fell in love, but they didn't say goodbye,
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty dark.
Right. She's not even 4. But it's very cute. I can't mimic the melody. It just wouldn't be the same. I'll post a link and you can listen. It's already got over 6 million views, probably more by the time this episode airs.
Holy cow.
Mm-hmm.
Sabrina likes doing spoken word versions of songs in general anyway, so.
That's true. It is more fun. Especially with lyrics like that, and you think, ooh, a 4-year-old came up with that.
It probably sounds cheerier and nicer when she's singing it.
Oh, definitely. The spoken word version. Yeah, definitely. Much cuter. Still.
This episode is brought to you by Rosetta Stone, the all-in-one language app.
How many ways can you say dinosaur? There's dinosaur.
Dinosaurio.
Konglong.
Dinosauro.
Okay, it's not enough to be able to say one word in multiple languages, but it is a fun start. And it's the start of amazing adventures, which reminds me of when we got to travel to Italy. In addition to all of the delicious food, we had the chance to check out the Natural History Museum of the University of Pisa, which has some pretty cool dinosaurs on display, including a replica Carnotaurus, which is known for having arms shorter than T-Rex and horns on its head, and it's identical to the original found in Argentina. They also have a reconstruction of a Saltosaurus nesting plan, and Saltosaurus are those long-necked dinosaurs covered in armor, and a really special gallery that shows the evolution of whales.
Oh yeah, I love the whale evolution. Yeah, we rented a car to go to the museum, and it helped to know some Italian to navigate around Italy, not surprisingly.
Mm-hmm.
I've been studying Italian for a little bit now, and it's a wonderful language. One of the coolest things about it is it's the modern version of Latin. So with dinosaur names, a lot of times the words are already familiar.
Not just the names, but like parts of dinosaurs.
Very true.
So enter Rosetta Stone. Learning languages really opens up the possibilities for adventure. And Rosetta Stone has been the expert in language learning for 30 years. It's designed so you can learn languages in an intuitive way and you remember your skills long term. And it ensures that you can pronounce each word.
And the best part is if you join now at rosettastone.com/dino, there's a special offer just for our listeners. And you can get more than 50% off lifetime access to 25 language courses. Again, that's rosettastone.com/dino, D-I-N-O.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
And now on to our dinosaur of the day, Tylocephalae, which was a request from Tyrant King via our Patreon and Discord, so thanks. It was a pachycephalosaurid that lived in the late Cretaceous in what is now Mongolia, in the Barungoyet Formation. The type species is Tylocephalae gilmori, and the genus name means swollen head.
Oh, God.
It was described in 1974 by Teresa Marianska and Halska Osmolska, and they found a partial damaged skull with the jawbone, the mandible, and some teeth. So not too much. But Tylocephalae had the tallest dome of any pachycephalosaur known so far.
Oh, it's that one.
Yep. The dome is so high that you can see the dome when you're looking at the skull from the back. You don't see this in the domes of other pachycephalosaurids. So the skull's very high and narrow and short, and it had thick bones on the roof of the skull. The bone in the back of the skull, the squamosal, is sharp and not swollen, and the dorsal portion, the back, of the squamosal forms a thick margin of the skull in the back. The ventral portion, the front, is thin.
So it's thicker in the back.
Yep.
And also sharp.
Somewhat, yeah. And the back of the squamosal on the roof of the skull has 8 nodes, so it looks a little decorative. There's a lot of debate over the dome. Did they use it for defense, attracting mates? Things like that. And we go into much more detail about pachycephalosaur domes in episode 93, Pachycephalosaurus, if you want to listen to that.
Spoiler alert, it could be all of the above.
True. There's been lots of debates.
Yeah.
Tylocephalae, though, had probably a good vision and a good sense of smell, and it had large teeth compared to other pachycephalosaurids. It was an herbivore, estimated to be 4.6 feet or 1.4 meters long, which is fairly small. It's closely related to Prenocephalae, which we cover in episode 98, if you want to hear about that one. Tylocephalae was probably bipedal and had long legs and a rigid tail. Pachycephalosaurids started in Asia and then migrated to North America, so Tylocephalae probably actually migrated back to Asia.
Oof. It's a long way to go.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's why I needed such a tall dome.
Maybe.
Had to have something to show for all that traveling.
I was wondering what the reasoning would be behind that.
I don't have good reasoning. And our fun fact of the day is a rabbit hole that I got into from that science paper that we talked about earlier.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah. The papers that are about new ideas and new hypotheses and trying to piece together new evidence are always the one that send me down the deepest rabbit holes, and I really enjoy them. So there was a line in the paper where they just mentioned that birds require between 15 and 20 times more food than a similar sized reptile. And that fact alone just cued me off on a whole bunch of tangents.
I could see that.
It's just so crazy. That's so much more food.
Yeah.
We did have a gecko for a little while, and it did surprise me how little food that it ate, because you basically fed it once or twice a week. I don't remember how often we had to feed it, and it was just like a few bugs, mm-hmm. and that was it, and it was done.
That's true, and it didn't move much.
Exactly. It was very conservative with its energy. It's like the show Naked and Afraid,
yep.
when they're like, my strategy is to just lay here and not do anything. That's sort of how reptiles are in general.
Also, FYI, our gecko's name was Littlefoot, and Littlefoot lived in a terrarium with a triceratops skull.
Yes.
Well, not a real skull, but...
It was a really awesome housewarming gift. And it didn't have little feet. It had huge, sticky feet.
Yeah.
But back to our fun fact. So... I wanted to figure out sort of an interesting analogy for this 15 to 20 times and how we could compare a couple of modern animals using that. So the largest archosaur, which is a reptile, to a bird. So the largest reptile on Earth is a saltwater crocodile, also known as a salty in Australia.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, it's great. They weigh about a ton, the biggest ones. So that's 1,000 kilograms, almost, you know, over 2,000 pounds. Super massive. They can be like 20 feet long. They're terrifying. Stay away from water. They can have salties. So to compare that, there's no birds that are anything like this. The biggest bird in history is the elephant bird. And it's, I think it was like 400 pounds or maybe 400 kilograms. It's not even close. So I decided to pick Gigantoraptor because I think Gigantoraptor, it's on that same Celurosaurian thread. It's an ornithomimosaur. It's pretty bird-like. We think it was covered in feathers. It definitely has a bird-like sort of posture, and a lot of its close relatives have been named things that are even include bird names in them. So it seemed like a pretty fun one. And Gigantoraptor is huge. It's got, you know, like the biggest eggs of anything ever, except for maybe the elephant bird. A young or small Gigantoraptor would weigh at least 1 ton. It was probably, as an adult, maybe twice or three times as big as a salty. So these things were massive and probably ate at least some meat because we think they were omnivores. So comparing Gigantoraptor, I used to think Gigantoraptor, yeah, it's kind of scary because it's big, but now thinking of it as 2 to 3 times the size of a saltwater crocodile, I have a whole new fear of these Gigantoraptors because they kind of look goofy. They have a short face. They don't have a big tooth-filled, crazy bone-crushing skull like T-Rex. But yeah, I think Gigantoraptor would definitely still be a little imposing. But to make it more interesting, I wanted to figure out how much a Gigantoraptor would have eaten compared to a saltwater crocodile. So fortunately for me, the South Australian government published guidelines on caring for salties in captivity. Which,
wow.
I just have to say, I love Australia. They just put this out into the world. Like, if you have a pet saltwater crocodile, here are some things you need to know.
It's useful.
It's amazing that even in South Australia, they're like, yeah, in case you got a salty, here you go. This is what you do. So they start the paper with just a wonderful line. They say, quote, "Crocodiles do not make good pets for the majority of people. However, with suitable experience, the right equipment, enough space and resources to set up an appropriate enclosure, crocodiles can be rewarding to keep." End quote.
I would never have guessed that.
I can't imagine how keeping a saltwater crocodile could be rewarding. But I guess if you really like crocodiles, it would be heartwarming to have your own in your yard.
Sure.
The most important part of the guidelines is their feeding recommendations. They have all sorts of other interesting recommendations, but I could talk about that for hours. What they recommend is that for an adult, you feed them about 10% of their body weight a week. So that's a lot more than I expected, first of all, because you always hear about crocodiles, how they can eat and then go like 6 months without eating. But I guess when they do eat, then they eat like their entire body mass so they can coast for a while. But in captivity, 10% of their body weight, it could be up to a ton. So that's a lot of meat that you have to feed these guys. Now, if you scale that up with the 15 to 20x, that means that Gigantoraptor would likely be eating about 150% to 200% of its body weight a week if that ratio holds up, which is a big if, because this is based on modern reptiles and birds, which are just so much smaller that it's hard to know if this would scale up. But if a Gigantoraptor is eating 150% to 200% of its body weight in a week, that means it's literally eating tons of food a week, which is the same scale as an elephant, except that Gigantoraptor was likely mixing in a lot of animals with its diet. So maybe the way to think of Gigantoraptor is like just a completely voracious, nonstop eating monster animal that makes a saltwater crocodile look like nothing.
Yikes. Could it be, if they were still around, do you think they could be rewarding to keep?
A Gigantoraptor?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. They'd probably be a little bit more interesting to have around than a salty, because every time I've seen a crocodile in an enclosure, it's basically just laying there unless you're going to feed it. Whereas birds, you know, they kind of run around. You could probably have a little bit more fun with them. Maybe like a pet bird, you could train it not to murder you. I don't think you can do that with a crocodile. I think any crocodile in captivity could basically eat you at any time without notice. But maybe you could train it like a parrot. Maybe it would talk at you or something. That could be kind of fun. But real quick, I want to give a couple other fun facts about salties because I learned a lot of fun stuff about them. One thing is they only live in warm water because they're ectotherms. So that's why we don't have them off the coast of California, for example, because it's too cold. But Australia is nice and warm, so they're all over the place there. They can also live for over 70 years in captivity. And for that reason, they said in their recommendations, keeping a crocodile is a long-term commitment.
Just like a parrot.
Exactly. And parrots are also archosaurs. So it's a similar sort of lifespan. But I think parrots would be more rewarding pets than saltwater crocodiles. And also, they talk about how you have to create this enclosure for them and clean it periodically and make sure that you are financially stable and everything in order to maintain this area.
And also put something in your will. Who do you bequeath the crocodile to?
Yeah. And like, their enclosures are not easy to clean. And you're signing up for 70 years of cleaning a crocodile enclosure if you get a pet one. Sounds like a horrible idea. But one other fun thing. They say that, quote, crocodiles can potentially eat any animal within its range, including kangaroos, wild boar, dingoes, goannas, birds, domestic livestock, water buffalo, sharks, and bats.
That's why you keep one, for protection.
It keeps away the bats and sharks.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I could see that. I can't imagine much of a better attack animal or like a moat having animal than a crocodile. No one's going to try to break into your house if they have to pass the path of a crocodile.
There you have it. Move to South Australia, build yourself a moat, get yourself a crocodile, you're set.
Because we don't have gigantoraptors, so that's your best option.
While you're at it, get a parrot.
Yeah, while you're signing up for 70-year commitments.
Yeah. Maybe they can be friends.
Maybe, yeah. Aren't there those birds that like eat the stuff out of crocodile teeth?
I think they're much smaller than parrots.
Oh, true. It might be too tempting.
Yeah. And that wraps up this episode of I Know Dino. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss out on any new episodes. And you can join our community at patreon.com/iKnowDino. Thanks again. And until next time.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.